3RPH is pleased to present the memoirs of Tilly Aston, Australia's blind poet, author and philanthropist. The story told of the many-faceted life of this talented woman is intriguing. The memoirs of Tilly Aston is published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. Episode 17.
We begin this episode with the speech delivered at the meeting of contributors called to adopt the incorporated constitution of the Association for the Advancement of the Blind on the 1st of December 1943. Ladies and gentlemen, this meeting of the contributors of the AAB has been summoned to consider a scheme for the incorporation under the Charities Act. And, as the scheme we submit differs in many respects from the one you aimed at, it is advisable that its consideration should be prefaced with some explanations. The incorporation sought by 25 of you, when you lodged a petition with the Charities Board, was such that it would have excluded from any voice in the management every blind person, including myself, and would have wrested from us, who have managed its affairs, every right and all assets we have won over a period of 48 years. This petition of yours was a shock to us, for no protest had come from you, no complaint that you were not satisfied with the conditions of spending the money which you gave for the good of the blind. The first intimation we had of the petition was from the Inspector of Charities, who, knowing the peculiar constitution and make-up of our organisation, felt that we blind people had rights as well as you. I do not know what inducement was offered to bring about your action, but the lodging of this petition behind our backs, so to speak, seemed to carry with it an implication that we blind people had been mismanaging your funds and doing you an injustice by not giving you a share in the control. This implication has been a cruel blow to the spirit of our blind people, the repercussions of which I view with the deepest sorrow. In this association, we had found a way of realizing our citizenship in service to others, service to a class about which we know infinitely more than the best informed of you, and to deprive us of the chance of a fuller life would be a graver injustice than any you can imagine has been done to you. Let me remind you of the origins of this work. 48 years ago, I called together a few blind friends to talk over the needs of our class, and we felt that there was indeed a great deal to be done. So we formed the Association for the Advancement of the Blind, and I have led it ever since. I need not go into details, but we started it with our own personal shillings, 8 of them in all, and we have gradually built up this very fine organisation, which is now to be incorporated. Through the years, we have had harmony, save for 1 or 2 family squabbles, and the best of the blind have always been linked up with us to help. Among these have been many who started and ran good businesses of their own, such as Mr. David Robertson, who is with us today, as he was at the foundation meeting. Mr. Blake, a successful grocer in Carlton, and others too numerous to mention. There were also retired businessmen who had lost their sight, such as Mr. T. Lowe, father of Justice Lowe, Mr. Holgate, accountant of a leading wool-broking firm, old Mr. Isaacs of the distinguished family of that name, and Mr. Campbell, the sound and wise old Scot who was president, if I remember rightly, of the Union of Engineers. Then there was George Maxwell, MLA, who even before his blindness was our friend, and later became our blind president. We still have Mr. Alfred Pierce, who, in spite of his loss of sight, goes on with his practice as a solicitor in the city. It was with the aid of such brains that we were able to go on building. But we were not so stupid as to imagine that we could run big finance and conduct homes and hostels without the aid of the sighted. All along the march of progress, we have had a host of outstanding men and women who were only too glad to help us run this work, asking nothing for themselves, and rejoicing with us in our aspirations after self-help in service. Let me mention a few of them. First was Miss Elsie Tate, now Mrs. Lawrence, who as a young girl stepped in to be our assistant secretary, and is still one of our best beloved friends. There were Robert Solly, Frank Tudor, O.R. Snowball, and W. H. Edgar, all public men, and in our Parliament. Sir Malcolm McKechin, who helped me in the negotiation for concessions on the tramways. There was Charles Monteith, a member of the founding firm in South Melbourne. Dr. S. McBurney, and, most loyal of all our friends, Mr. and Mrs. W. H. Patterson. These and a host besides of good-seeing folk stood by us and helped us to realise our ideals, and so we kept on building and growing. I want to take this final opportunity of assuring you that at no time in the 48 years of our history has the public money been in danger of misuse. Always, at least from the time when we began to launch out in a bigger way, we had ample guards for the funds. A cited businessman as our treasurer, a vigilant committee, qualified auditors, and intense economy was effected, because the blind themselves did much of the work without any remuneration. We doubt whether any organisation working for the good of our handicapped citizens ever did more with the funds collected than we did with ours, which never exceeded £3,000 in the best year. But today we desire to lay aside reproaches and protests and to bind together our forces into a solid block for the sake of the cause. As before stated, the Inspector of Charities suggested that a scheme by which both blind and sighted might share in the control of the work could be devised under Section 67 of the Charities Act. This section makes it possible for the contributors to adopt at a special meeting a set of bylaws providing for this form of government. The matter was handed over to a committee of our association, and after months of deliberation, in which we sought the best legal advice, a constitution has been drawn up which meets the approval of the Charities Board. Mr. Adam, who has been our legal adviser throughout, is here today to help us if necessary, so we submit the plan with confidence, believing that you will accept it for the sake of the 48 years in which we blind people have carried on the work. We need your cooperation now as much as we ever needed our sighted friends, but we are certain that you also need ours, if the best results are to follow this change of policy, since we can bring to the work that equipment born of experience as fellows and brothers of those whom we desire to comfort and bless. So, ladies and gentlemen, we present the new bylaws for your adoption. Tilly Aston, President. Frank Smiley, the 17th of August, 1944. Today I have bidden farewell to a friend whom I valued and respected most sincerely. This was Frank Smiley, president of the Old Cobb & Co. Coach Drivers Association, who has gone from this earthly scene at the ripe age of 87. As we sat in the Presbyterian Church, Alma Road, St. Kilda, where he attended and served as session clerk, I felt that a more fitting send-off could not have been devised for him. The casket rested where the beautiful lights from the pictured window fell upon it, surrounded by a mass of glorious flowers, with the organ singing its soft, sweet melodies and the hush of reverence over the big congregation assembled. It was just as he would have wished it. He loved beauty, flowers, music, and the dignities of life. The clergyman, Reverend Alexander Fraser, spoke such words of the departed as I should like to have heard of my own father, and, as his friend, they moved me deeply and filled me with pride. So he passed on to his grave at St. Kilda Cemetery. Yet I know he will live in the memory of a host of his fellows, to whom his cheerful personality was like a sea breeze in summer. During recent years, I had seen a good deal of this remarkable old man. Often in the cold evenings he would drop in at my cottage for a chat, happy and comfortable in the glow of the fire, since he was only boarding at a house where a warm hearth was a rare amenity. We would talk of our mutual friends and acquaintances, swap yarns, and have a bit of old-time music, of which he was very fond. In his younger days, he sang a very good tenor, so I would brush up some of his songs, and while I played on the piano, Romany Lass, Good Company, and Queen of the Earth, he would join in with what voice age had left to him. Needless to say, yarns of coaching days were always to the fore. And what did it matter if sometimes they were repeated again and again? Mr. Smiley used to delight in telling me how he drove the Western District magnates up and down to Ballarat for cattle sales, weddings, funerals, and elections. One special pride was his that he had driven Lady Hodges to Ballarat to buy her trousseau when she was preparing for her first marriage to one of the Chernsides. This most gracious lady always kept in touch with Mr. Smiley. From her famous garden at Dreamthorpe, Macedon, she would send him quantities of choice flowers when he had one of his pilgrimages to the graves of old-timers. He introduced her to me through my books, and I had some correspondence with her, and an invitation to visit her garden, a pleasure I missed as war came, and I was unable to travel up to the Mount before the mistress of Dreamthorpe passed away. When Mr. Smiley broke his thigh, I wrote this news to her, and her immediate reply was a magnificent basket of fruit and flowers delivered at his bedside in the Alfred Hospital. One day, Frank asked me if I would write a verse or two for the annual report of the coach drivers. I gave him the tribute which appears at the end of this sketch, and which I also read over the air on one occasion, much to his delight. As a result, I was elected an honorary member of the Old Cobb & Co. Coach Drivers Association, and included in the invitations to the annual dinner given to members by Mr. and Mrs. Wallace Mitchell. It was always a gala day, and I enjoy meeting the old boys, pioneers of early and arduous travel into the outback regions of this state. I fear it may not be quite the same now the genial president is not with us. The friend whom I have farewelled today was a very interesting man, clean in body and mind, with the outlook of a youth in most matters, splendid in physique, his long, capable hands betokening fine breeding somewhere. He had not fallen a victim to the petty vices which were apt to beset the men who shuttled up and down the roads 50 or 60 years ago. Alcohol and tobacco he did not use, and apart from the tales which he himself owned up to be snake yarns, as he called them, he was a worshipper at the altar of truth. He gave me as a keepsake the book When Cobb & Co. Was King, written by Will Lawson. In it was embodied the story of the boyhood of Frank Smiley. Although the book as a whole does not conform to facts as far as his later life is concerned. I visited him a week or two back, when his strength was failing sadly. He held my hand and said, "The long day closes." And I agreed. He then said, "The anthem says, 'He giveth his beloved to sleep.'" And thus he went away, in the firm faith that for him the future was full of goodness and peace. So, farewell, friend of mine. And here is Tilly's tribute to the old coach drivers. Especially to my friend Frank Smiley. Resting where a sun-kissed wattle spread its tent beside the road, mid the hills where browsing cattle blessed the earth for gifts bestowed, far away among the rises, faint and far, the echoes sound, though the distance still disguises throbbing hoof-beats on the ground. Round the bend and down the valley, where the gracious waters flow, through the blue gums' shady alley comes the coach of Cobb & Co. Roll of wheels and harness jingle, snapping whips and shouts of cheer, how it makes the red blood tingle as the racing team draws near. Dust and tumult, then it passes, outward with its daily dole, lifting from despair's morasses many a desert-ridden soul. Echoes, memories, golden dreaming, in this age of speeding car, gone the days of coaches streaming o'er the highways flung afar. But a grateful salutation to those valiant men I bring, builders in our growing nation, when old Cobb & Co. was king. New friends. One of the saddening features of old age is the loss of capacity to make and keep new friends. A loss the more keenly felt because the ranks of old ones are rapidly thinning down. In time, the older folk find their intimacies reduced to a mere handful of acquaintances, and thus they miss so much of the supreme enjoyment that had been the stay and radiance of their earlier days. Realizing this, I have clung tenaciously to every chance of acquiring new friends and of fostering cordial relations. if not sincere affection, wherever it seemed possible. I feel that I have succeeded, and I go on enriching my experience with the warm intercourse between myself and many people, both old and young, some of whom are now one contacts of quite recent times. It is with considerable pleasure, therefore, that I tell the brief story of my interest in Stan and Betty Brogdon, still little more than infants in arrival within my closer circle. Years ago, when I was in my early 20s, I sometimes paid a visit to my sister Sophia at Carisbrook, and on one occasion I met there some young Welshmen, lovers of singing and endowed with excellent voices. They were cousins, two Joneses and a Roberts, all of the enthusiastic type, and they soon ganged up with me for a jolly good old sing-song in the evenings. Before I returned to Melbourne, we gave a concert for the benefit of the Presbyterian Church. The whole programme was made up of this irregular quartet of ours, and we got plenty of fun out of rolling out the old songs, to which were added a couple of Welsh hymns, which I happened to know, and the time-honoured glees, The Wreath, The Village Chorister, and Hail Smiling Morn. We thought the programme rather good, and so did the audience, apparently, if encores count for anything. Well, I did not meet these young singers again, as they had moved to another district before my next visit to my native town. Then, about 9 years ago, the Sun newspaper gave me a good write-up, and a few weeks later a young lady called at my home, told me she was Betty Roberts, a teacher from the MacRobertson High School, and that her father, now living near Warrigal, had seen the article in the Sun and had asked her to look me up and find out if I were the same Miss Aston at the Carisbrook concert. In this manner I became acquainted with Mrs. Betty Roberts, a charming girl of intense enthusiasms, and quickly a genuine attachment sprang up between us. It grew to be a regular practice with her to drop in for a chat after school, and soon I felt that I had accomplished that difficult thing, the attainment of a real friendship between a young woman like Betty and myself, a woman of 60. Betty liked books and music, and our tastes in these matters were identical. She also appreciated my own literary efforts, a capital basis on which to build up a mutual liking. By and by, there appeared on the scene a young man friend, who was duly introduced to me, and at once fell into his own particular niche in my esteem. I soon perceived that my two young friends had a more than ordinary interest for each other. I watched their love affair growing, until they came along one day to tell me the surprising news of their engagement. Of course, I was really not surprised, but let that go. The lover of Betty was a young literary aspirant, who had spent some time in London doing freelance and journalistic work. For the time at least, he meant to stay in Australia, and now there was the dear girl to serve as an additional anchor to this end. Stan Brogdon and Betty Roberts were married, and now together they are aiming at big things in the realm of letters, towards which a start has been made by the publication of several small books. At this time of writing, 1945, it is not quite clear in exactly what sphere of authorship Stan will be most successful, but succeed he will, for all the thrill and enthusiasm of Betty Roberts still surges up in Mrs. Stan Brogdon, and cannot fail to stimulate her husband to yet higher and higher efforts. I may not live to see the crown of their lives in this direction, but I am glad to share their hopes of youth, to lend a sympathetic ear, and to lay bare before them my own plans and aspirations. I shall always remember two opportunities which Stan put in my way. The first was a broadcast interview on 3XY, the first broadcast of that kind in which I was heard over the air. It brought me some publicity and some fan mail, renewing some neglected friendships and bringing fresh aspects of life to my notice. The other experience which came to me through Stan was an invitation to go out to Heidelberg Military Hospital to speak to a group of the boys in the programme of the Army Education Service. I greatly dared when I talked about the appreciation of poetry on the Australian countryside, but the dear invalids listened and at the end gathered around me in a swarm, asking questions and examining my braille notes with interest. Possibly the lady lecturer was more important to them than what she said. If so, I hope some spirit of courage went forth to these lads in their hour of trouble. It is in this wise that Stan and Betty Brogdon bring to me a sense of goodwill and almost a filial respect, not always granted to one as the years pile up. There are others of the present day, younger writers, whom I have met sometimes, such as Edward Harrington, perhaps the true successor to Henry Lawson. But with most of these, I have not established anything like an intimate association. With Cyril Good, it is different. With him and his wife, I have found a relationship more cordial and friendly. This young author and poet has been through the mill of adversity, and in places his work bears the mark of it. Still, he can draw from the depths of experience so much that is sweet and beautiful that I feel him to be a spirit akin to my own. While his hands toil with metal and machines, for he is an engineer and mechanic, his thoughts roam over the bush and bring back to the written page all the colour and light that a poet would find there, and a sense of quiet joy is often with him as he writes. In his little home at Newport, Melbourne, shared with his devoted wife and small daughter, he lives with his books and garden, and sings his songs and tells his stories whenever the pressure of life permits. Like Stan Brogdon, his niche as an author is awaiting him in the future, and may it be a very warm and comfortable spot for him, when time has done all it can for his art and powers. But to return to the Brogdons, with them I can laugh and offer playful suggestions, and one such gesture is the set of verses following, which were sent to Betty once when she was on vacation, and wrote that she was making a shrub garden at her parents' home. I told her that my superior list of summers lived entitled me to offer advice. And here's the advice. When Betty makes a garden, with shrubs and bushes planned, I'd like to be upon the spot and lend a helping hand. For when the spring and summer call forth the blossoms there, I know in Betty's garden I'd surely have a share. She'd give me showery wattle, as gold as dawning day, and crimson rambler roses warm and cool and snowy May, long chains of bright laburnum and butter-coloured broom, and thus would Betty's garden make sunshine in my room. If I were Betty's neighbour, and full her garden grown, I'd sniff the breathing odour rich in through my window blown, from loquat flower and almond and oleander tall, from laurel and from lilac, the dearest of them all. Yes, straight from Betty's garden she'd bring me lilac flower, in mauve, like stately lady in old-time lady's bower. And wreaths of honeysuckle she'd pilfer from the bee, and jasmine from the trellis, to share them all with me. When Betty makes a garden, for shrubs and bushes planned, I'd like to be godmother there, and name the lovely band. Thus I, in Betty's garden, would have a rightful share, and in my quiet chamber I'd breathe its incense rare.
And that brings us to the end of episode 17 of The Memoirs of Tilly Aston, published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pam Adams. The series was produced in the studios of 3RPH Melbourne for the RPH Network.